Welcome back to the TV Talk Machine podcast, where we talk about television with Tim Goodman, the chief TV critic of The Hollywood Reporter. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Jason. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm your co-host, Jason Stellan, of course, and sometimes I'm not here. And when that happens, another person fills in. His name is David Lohr. I think I hear his voice.
Why, hello there.
Oh, no, it's the three-man booth, Tim. You are looking live at Mile High Stadium.
The dreaded three-man booth.
It's back.
We love it.
So we called David in for he's going to be our resident Mad Men expert to talk finale with you, because as I've mentioned on past podcasts, while I've seen episodes of Mad Men, I have not seen any for a few years because I am a bad person. Mm-hmm. So David is our designated ringer for Mad Men finale discussion. But before we get there, I thought we could also talk maybe a little bit about David Letterman leaving. This was it. It's over. The era of the Letterman show is over. I want to point out to people who haven't seen it that they should check out. I did a thing on The Incomparable last week. It's Incomparable number 247. It's a 1 hour kind of documentary-ish thing that I did,
yes,
featuring mm-hmm. interviews with many luminaries about David Letterman. Well, okay, people I know who like David Letterman, and one of them is Tim. So you're in there, and if people like you and don't mind listening to me, they should check it out.
And it's quite good.
Thank you, David. Yes. This is why I brought David here.
Yeah, quite good.
Complimentary things about
you. You are correct, sir.
So the Letterman finale, what'd you think?
Wow, I loved it. The build up, and of course I wrote something about it. I guess we can link to that, and we can link to the great podcast that you did for in fan notes for people, and mm-hmm. you know, the run up to it, I loved it. Because it erased my biggest fear, which in the piece that I tried to express was that, you know, I think that by the time he made the decision to go, he was ready to go, and there was that element of staying a little bit too long. And as much as it didn't bother me when I tuned in and I felt like he had checked out, I just didn't watch those episodes because they weren't very exciting. So in this last month, this last farewell tour, it's been so great to see him both just laughing and in the moment and back on his game and connected. And in this final week in particular, it's been really amazing because everybody's been so emotional. And there's all this real love there. And, you know, I loved the finale. I had a friend of mine come over. He doesn't actually get his actual TV. So we watched it over here, at my place, and, it was great. It was so much fun. I loved how they set it up. I thought that it was touching without being maudlin, and I didn't have to like cry a bunch of times. I laughed a ton of times, and I thought it was like kind of the perfect way to go out.
I think I still got Everlong stuck in my head by Foo mm-hmm. Fighters. That montage that Barbara Gaines, who's been with Letterman for three decades, and some of her other staff, she said on Twitter that they've been putting that montage together every Friday since December.
Wow.
And it showed. It is mind blowing, mm-hmm. and they did a great job. And to do it, you know, essentially it's being played live by Foo Fighters in the background. That's pretty crazy. But
right.
It's also like watching your life pass before your eyes. Because I mean, they did it in you know, at the beginning, it's in chronological order, and it's I recognize so much of it that I just like, oh my god, like if you went frame by frame, I could probably identify. It was just amazing. So I thought they did a really great job, and it was like a really nice way to send it off, was to say, you know, here's our scrapbook and now we're done. And I love the people, you know, coming on and them being affected by it. Like last week when Jon Stewart said something about it, when Conan O'Brien in his monologue on that night said, you know, what Dave's support of him meant to him. And then when it came to 11:35, he just said, change the channel. And
yeah.
There was a big thing that said, turn to Dave now.
Yeah, that was great.
I thought that was really touching. And I know that David Letterman is not gonna, he doesn't want to hear it, but that was kind of a nice way to do it. And yeah, I thought it was great too. We stayed up and watched the whole thing live, and it was a moment. It was a real TV moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I was saying to the kids, you know, intellectually I can say, all right, 33 years, that's, you know, three quarters of my life basically. And yet you watch that compressed montage and it's just overwhelming, especially at that speed, you know. And that's, I think they said it was 562 individual clips and stills. And
wow,
that's what that is. Some guy on Facebook, and I'll send you the link so you can link to this too. Someone isolated all of the images and is annotating them to say, okay, this is from this year.
I love the internet.
This is, and it is amazing. I was scrolling through it earlier and just going, okay, I never saw that episode. I never saw that one. What's that? Oh, look, there's Terry Garr. Awesome. And there were a couple of things that I had missed, even though I've already watched the finale like three times now.
Terry Garr in the towel is definitely in there from the from the Too Hot to Do a Show episode. It's in there. Yeah, I thought it was great, right? It wasn't maudlin and mawkish and all of those things, and I think that was just fine.
Yeah, I think that I mean it could have been overly sentimental. I was ready to go there. I was ready to just sort of bawl my eyes out the whole thing, and would have been just fine with that. But it felt big, you know. It felt like even for people who were younger and not getting it, you know, they're more of the Kimmel or the Fallon group. It's great to know that like Fallon and Kimmel and Cohen and everybody that they are now identifying as the people that they will say, oh, I was in college when or high school or in college when I watched those late night hosts. Because I think when you're younger like that, watching late night television hosts is kind of a thing. I think it was great that they could see them and you know, their Letterman, so to speak, say back to them, hey, switch channels, go watch this guy. He was a legend.
So you know what's funny? The 13-year-old made a really good point that he doesn't care about the other guys because you can see all the interesting things on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And even though, yeah, Letterman was putting stuff on YouTube, or The Late Show was, you know, you had to watch the show. It wasn't the same chopped up into little comedy bits.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that was the special thing. He can watch the Comedy Central stuff on Hulu. He can watch all the Fallon viral stuff goes, you know, it's out. Sometimes they put it out before the show even airs.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a special thing. You stay up to watch David Letterman. And he was like, I'm going to miss this show.
Mm-hmm.
They're both of them are ready for Colbert.
So, oh, yeah. That'll be something else.
Bring them on for sure. Well, should we move on to the other big milestone of this last week?
Uh-huh.
All right.
What would that be?
So the I hear, well, Tim.
Well, it's the moment where Dave closes his eyes and smiles and then imagines this montage of no.
So Mad Men finale, it happened. We forward promoted last week, talked about it. Before I go back into the bushes here for a while you guys talk about it, I just wanted to point out nobody went out a window.
Nope.
And D.B. Cooper did not rob an airplane.
Nope.
Nope.
Just to put a cap on those fearless predictions. All right, we should definitely talk about the Mad Men finale. I will be back when you're done.
Okay.
Good luck, gentlemen.
Thank you. Our heroic and fearless leader.
Is he gone yet?
He's gone. I'll tell you. I wrote a couple of things about this, obviously, and I think I think you actually read both of them. Mm-hmm. By the way, so that's good. And David, and it was amazing finale. I think that, you know, strip away this final minute, literally the 60-second end of it, which I think brought up some interpretation issues, and one in which I went back and wrote another 2,000-plus words about that minute. If you take that away just for right now and focus just on the finale itself, I think that it was pretty magnificent. And the more I think about it and understand what kind of coup that was for Matt Weiner to pull off, it's kind of amazing because with the things that strike me, you know, right off the top are, like Jason said, he didn't do the two things that would have, I think, in my book, kind of like ruined it. Like, okay, Don falls out the window and it was there in the credits the whole time. You know, this crazy D.B. Cooper thing, which I never understood.
And none of this stuff. Agent Cooper from Twin Peaks.
Right, exactly. That's different. And nothing that was just sort of so randomly out of nowhere that it became the issue that people talked about. What did happen was he surprised us. I think in the beginning moments, like I can say that I honestly don't think many people thought the last episode, the finale, was going to open on the salt flats with Don yeah. doing 130 miles an hour racing a car. It was just image wise. It was just like, okay. I think my notes said, did not see this coming. And it was great. And it's like, okay, now what fresh weirdness is this? And what does this mean? But we knew that he was still on the road. And we knew we were going to meet some new characters for the first time, but that he also got rid of those characters pretty quickly because they were a vehicle to continue Don's on the road trip, and that got him into California where I thought he was going all along, and then things took off from there. But the things, David, that struck me were it was interesting and unique in its own story. There was an hour-long story yes. in the finale that was interesting and unique. At the same time, what it did was wrapped up stuff, advanced stories, and ramped them up. I mean, we knew Pete and Trudy got together previously, something that I was very happy to call. And in the finale, we saw that Stan and Peggy got together in this very same column several weeks ago. I predicted that. And very happy to see that coming. And I think a lot of fans want to see Peggy happy. And you have all this stuff where it's like it was meat for the viewers, right? Like you could see what was happening to everybody. Roger and Marie look happy, and Joan has a twist all her own in the final hour, which was a story that he was concocting fresh while he wrote it, and yet gave her that little oomph of a completed story arc that wrapped it up. At some point, and we kind of already wrapped up Betty earlier because we know she was dying. So we had really neatly and compactly in that hour Don on a journey, which we didn't know where he was going. So that was the underlying story. Like, okay, his story is not done. Everybody else's story pretty much wrapped up. And I thought that they did it in a way that wasn't too saccharine. I didn't get a sugar cavity from doing that. I didn't feel like it was right. a false step. I was touched and moved by it. And at the same time, which I think is key to this, David, I was like, okay, you've given me all of this stuff, and now you still have the story to finish. And so I thought, and then, you know, when he got to the point where he finished that story, and we can talk about that in a minute, I also thought it was brilliant. So like, if you think about how stories end, boy, he had a lot of balls in the air, and he did a great job keeping him afloat.
I think so, yeah. I mean, one of the things I've loved about the show from the beginning is the symbolism and the resonances that he builds in there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, opening the show on the salt flats was, you know, right there. That's the rest of the series in microcosm to me. Because what is it? He's driving hard, he's driving fast, and he's going nowhere.
Right.
Uh-huh. And, you know, and it's sort of like all of that is just compressed right down in there. And of course, you know, it's balanced out by the end where he finally gets somewhere and he stops and he can just rest.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and we'll get to the ending in a minute. But yeah, I mean, just to have that as the bookends for the episode. And then to wrap up all those stories, and I, you know, I saw some people commenting on Twitter that, oh, he's giving them all happy endings. Well, no, he's giving them all endings.
Right.
They're not necessarily happy. We don't know that. You know, everyone thinks, oh, well, now I'm at the happy ending point. And then, you know, when Don married Megan, maybe that was a happy ending. Who knows? You know?
Right. He put them at the beginning, I think, in fairness, David, he put them in a situation where they were happy in the initial phase of their next step of their life.
Right.
Without telling us how it ends.
And I mean, the whole series also reminds me of, I think I tweeted this at you the other day. It reminds me of John Updike and mm-hmm. especially the Rabbit books, which are, I mean, the first one's called Rabbit Run. I mean, that's what he did all his life. Mm-hmm. And he's a salesman. He's a car salesman, but it's a similar kind of dynamic. And so it's been interesting to see, you know, is he going to follow that storyline? Is he going to just updike it and have him run at the end? And it's been interesting to see variations there. And yeah, I mean, all of these characters, I get it. I'm a writer. I like my characters. And so mm-hmm. I'm happy that he wanted to see them at least for the moment happy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, just Stan and Peggy. Oh, my God. You know, two different and wonderful line readings of the word. What?
Yes. So
I mean,
great.
That. Oh, I just love that.
I mean, that's just a stop right there. I mean, that's a great scene in itself. It's like that to me was like is self-contained, where Matt Weiner was taking Mad Men back to what one of the things it does really well, which is also it's funny. You know, yes. the guy's been a comedy writer his whole life. So I found that was funny, and at the same time it was touching. And I thought, okay, wow, okay, you're kind of balancing these two tones. And Stan took the right tact. He's a calm Zen presence when Peggy kind of wigs out. And so when Peggy was kind of not getting the fact that Stan was admitting that he's loved her and he's loved her for a while and he doesn't want her to leave. And it's what? This whole thing, that scene in itself became really great. And here's the thing that I saw somebody also say, I mean, everybody has reactions, but somebody said, oh, that was a little too, two people in love. I was like, well, you know what? You could argue that the buildup to that took forever. And so really an audience deserves that moment when two people for the first time are going to talk to each other about that and be together. Of course, you're going to have this warm, fuzzy moment, and that it would be false if it wasn't warm and fuzzy. Right. But as you said, what we don't know is are they ever going to get married? Will they have kids? Will they be happy? I mean, those are things we don't know. And structurally, as I mentioned in my piece, that's the brilliance of how he chose to do this, which was similar to David Chase in The Sopranos, where you just close the window, the viewing window that we viewers saw. You don't close the lives. You don't end the lives on the other side of the window. And that's I love that kind of storytelling, because it's like we're going to wrap it for you guys, and this is what you're going to see, and let your minds go wild as to what's going to happen in the future. When we shut this window, you don't see what happens and their lives go on. And I think it allowed him as a storyteller to really stretch the stories and make them, I think, very grounded, very real.
Yeah. And there, you know, I've seen this in a couple of places where it really is a show that paid attention to how humans behave, mm-hmm. right? It was never really artificial. It was never, you know, hey, let's do this because we're a drama, or let's do this because we're a soap. You know, it you know, even in Don's sort of his little revelations and then backsliding through the last seven seasons, mm-hmm. you know, that was very realistic. Mm-hmm. You know, it is two steps or one step forward, two steps back
right.
for some people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where a lot of people are getting tripped up by the ending. I don't know if you mm-hmm. want to get to the ending.
Sure,
just yet,
yeah, absolutely.
But, mm-hmm. You know, in saying, oh, this is cynical. Oh, he's just going to go back to the way he was. Oh, you know, whatever. But I think it's very clear that he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I loved your pieces, especially. I think it's very clear that, you know, I mean, throughout, like when he gets to, I mean, they never say it out loud, but it's basically the Esalen training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely Esalen.
Mm-hmm. Esalen,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in that early scene when it's like, all right, we're just going to stand around and then do whatever physicality occurs to you about the other person. And almost every one of them is, you know, touching or caressing or hugging. And he's just standing there with his arms folded in that body language of get the hell away from me.
Yeah.
And the woman across from him just shoves him in the chest and that's it. That's this wonderful, just again, the microcosm of his life. He starts out there very closed off, very confrontational. He gets pushed. Nobody hugs him. Nobody likes him. He can't sell anything to anyone there. And every time he tries to sell something, it's like, no, you'll do better just going forward. Oh, Dick, I don't think you're right.
That was a great line. Right. Yeah, I think you're right about that. Yeah.
And the look on his face was just, you know, ooh. And then the phone call with Peggy, where, you know, everything is stripped away. He is a shell, right? There's nothing left. There's no Don Draper. There's no Dick Whitman. There's no career. There's no family. There's nothing.
Right.
And you know, if you want to say it was in the opening credits the whole time, it's there too. What's the first thing we see when we see that silhouette? Everything falling away.
Mm-hmm.
And then Leonard talks. And, you know, and I was watching with Twitter because that's what I'm doing these days.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people are like, who is this guy? Why is he talking? There's 6 minutes left. Shut up. And I'm like, listen to him, maybe. Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe listen to him. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you know, to see Don just completely fall apart and walk over and not just hug him, but embrace him and hold on for dear life. And that was the breakthrough. He's never done quite that far. And he's never found someone who had those feelings too. And it was like he understood his entire life in that moment. And so it makes sense to me that, yes, he would be at peace. Yes, he's there for far more than 2 days or 3 days,
right,
or however long people are assuming.
Right.
And that when he goes back, and he will go back because he is going to need money, he is going to need a career. That's what comes out of it. This ad that is not just, it's not that it's a completely cynical, let's co-opt the hippies and sell coke. Even in real life, it came out of a very genuine sense of, hey, we could do more than just sell coke.
Exactly.
We can be a community. We can make a better world. And by the way, here's who's paying for this ad, right? Whereas in the first episode, he's very cynical about family and community and the carousel pitch. Mm-hmm. And it's everything is for selling. And now it's not just selling the product, it's selling the community. It's selling the better world.
Right.
Which I thought was a lovely closing the circle from the beginning.
Well, and also to complete that too, is that nostalgia is looking backwards and this app is looking forward. And
yes.
I think that there's, I think what's going to make, I think he's going to add on. I think everything about this finale, he definitely stuck the landing. Everything's great about it. I think where it will grow in resonance is that when we all start putting some of the pieces together. And I think that I know that Matt Weiner had for a lot of critics, had a very frustrating last talk about this. He had only agreed that he would talk about it at the New York Public Library with a writer, A.M. Holmes. And she seems very disinterested in talking about what everybody else wanted to talk about was the finale, that last minute. What did it mean? Was it jaded, et cetera? I think people who were there, Alan Sepinwall and other people and big write-ups that have come from it and verbatim accounts of it, and Weiner's own words are pretty clear. I think it would be a struggle to interpret it in any other way, that it was a positive ending. And Weiner's the couple things that he said were really interesting. I just wanted to backtrack for a second. Is that my take was that Don did have this transformation, and I documented that. It's like, you know, he didn't. It wasn't. This was a culmination of all the, you know, the steps that he was taking. And you talked about through the course of the season, he would, you know, one step forward, two steps back. I think in season seven, the interesting part is it's two steps forward, one step back.
Yes.
He was getting better. He was getting better at it. He wasn't perfect. He was learning to change. He still made mistakes. He still struggled. He still got called out on his shortcomings, particularly when he made one of the three calls and it was talking to Betty about, you know, he is a loving father, but you're often an absent father because you're doing these other things. She wanted them to have a mother figure. And again, I think the structure of the series is going to allow, as we perceive what will be in the future, I absolutely 1000% believe that Don will, he's obviously gone back to New York. I believe he will take care of his kids. I think that that's in him. I think the change is there. So when he got to Esalen, this was all set up for him to make these dramatic shifts. And the thing is, it didn't, the last scenes, the last half hour or so when we were at Esalen, it wasn't like a magic pill. This is, he had worked hard to get there, and he had never ever allowed himself, as you talked about, he had never allowed himself to be in a therapeutic situation. And I like the fact that A, it was very relevant to the era, even though now it's relevant to the modern times as well. But in the 70s, it was definitely a thing. I like the fact that as a historian, Matt Weiner knew that Esalen in the 70s was a breakthrough organization. We're really helping people, and you could put him in that situation. And as you documented, he didn't take to it at the beginning. He wanted to flee. He was told by Stephanie that great line, like, oh Don, I don't think that's true, where he said, if you just keep moving, everything will be better as you go forward. And she says, no, oh Don, I don't think that's true. And she's right, it's not. You have to turn and face it at some point. You can't keep fleeing the past. And so when she takes the car, that's
where the salt flats comes in,
right,
where it's just that straight line and you never turn and you never go back. It's always forward. That's how you break the land speed record. Maybe you don't need to break it.
Right, exactly. And I loved how it all tied together. And you know, that notion of her taking the car and leaving him stranded there was fantastic, right? And it just – and the thing is, when he has this – that scene that you did was great, because he didn't have the capacity to talk about his emotions. He didn't want to hug some strange woman in front of him. And her reaction at the same time was legitimate, like, okay – why are you even here? You're just an idiot. I'm going to push
jerk.
You. You jerk. And I pushed him, right? And then so for him to not hug there and then hug later after his breakdown, I think what's interesting too when we look back on it is he has to talk about his on-the-road trip. And when Peggy confronts him and basically says, where are you? And he's just like, somewhere in California, because he went quote unquote up the coast from California by Stephanie. And it was nothing he planned. He has no plans. He's a doer. He just goes. So he didn't really know where the hell he was. And then she's like, what are you doing there? He's like, I don't know. I have no idea. And it stripped him bare to the point where she's just like, you know, her telling him and that phone call, you can come home. People love you. You know, we're here to help you, et cetera, was great. Cause when he went into the scene, and I love how you set that scene up, like, because that's what I knew was going to happen, David, is that people were going to flip out. Like, okay, wait a minute. Cause, and I had written about how people start watching the clock, even though they shouldn't be. They're like, oh my God, there's not enough time for me to get the ending I want. And who the hell is this Leonard guy? And why is he talking so much? But the genius for me is Weiner saying, and he said later when he was at the library talk after the finale, saying it was one of the most important characters and one of the most difficult casting he's ever done. That guy had to be perfect. And I noticed, as you notice, he's not a hippie, right? He's just a normal guy. He's not as flashy as Don, so he's not like trying to huckster his way out of there. He's just a guy in a sweater who feels like he can't be seen. He's not loved. He doesn't know what love is. So I love
– And nobody notices him. Nobody gives him love.
Right, exactly.
And to have Peggy's words in the back of his mind after Sally's and Betty's, you know, to have the last thing in his head is, you know, you come home. We love you. It's okay. You know? It's just devastating.
It's so good. And the notion in that moment that you know, he could have this breakthrough with this character saying things that he doesn't have to say, which I thought again was a real a smart idea on a Weiner's part, where you have this character who does a, you know, 6-minute dialogue about his feelings, and Don is, he's just come from this thing where he basically empties himself on the phone to Peggy, and he does it in a way that looked like he almost had a heart attack. You know, I mean, you could read that scene like he's going to die. He broke down. He can't think. He's almost in a fugue state when he can't even get up. So when this woman who's a counselor there finds him and is going to escort him, and I love how they handled that. You know, she didn't try to pick him up. And he says, I can't get up. And she says, well, I can't go in to my session by myself. And it's a technique. It's an enabling technique where it's like, we're going to help each other. I'm not going to just reach down and pick you up and do it myself. You are going to, something inside of you is going to say, I need to help this woman. And so this gets me forward. I need to help this person get where they need to go. And she's going to help me get where I need to go. And they get into that session and it all happens. He's in that session. He's still almost comatose until Leonard's speech. I love that little slight nod of Don's head as he wakes up. He hears that story and he totally relates to it. And that's where he has the, you know, where he crosses, as you, I think you said it so well, he crosses over the, and not only hugs him, but holds on for dear life and is bawling. And the way they shot it, with him really gripping him tight, it's like, I you know what I mean? I'm here for you and I understand this and I get this.
And to have this character who, for seven seasons, I mean, what is he all about? He's about the power of words. He's about the salesmanship and, you know, he can spin anything anytime, anywhere. And the last, I don't know, 6-7 minutes of the series, he doesn't say a single word.
Right.
Right. Mm. And again, that's, again, that says to me again, the change that comes over him. And that, you know, and they set it up so beautifully through the years. You know, you always like to run. You only like to see the beginnings of things.
Mm-hmm.
You never see the endings.
Right.
And he's done that consistently. And I think that sort of sets this up again to say, yeah, he's going to go back and see these things through now.
Yeah.
All these things that he's ignored. You weren't there for the kids. You don't care about the kids. You don't care about this. You don't care about Coke.
Mm-hmm.
But I you know, it's all there for me. I don't see why people are so cynical about it.
Well, it's what I found interesting too, and it's almost like as you break it down scene by scene, and I did that in the sort of second one or the refutation of it being a cynical ending. I think it's important to understand that the next time after that shot, we see Don in completely different clothes. Which is really important. So he has spent the night there. We technically don't even know if it's the next day. We just know some amount of time has passed. And Don looks calm, right?
Yeah. And then when we see him sitting yoga style, I think he's in different clothes yet again.
Yeah. And it's
a different time of day, different situation.
And the thing too is about that, which it goes, everything goes really quickly. A guy like Don, who's never done this before, he does not get into that yoga pose by himself.
Right.
Right. That told me that's not the first time he's done that. So he has, you know, and we're using this open-ended time construct that Weiner allowed. And as I wrote about, he was at Esalen much longer than we thought he was as it was shot in the scene. And I think that so many little pieces of evidence are important about that. But him getting into that cross-legged meditation scene and going into the om, you know, he's done that before. He wouldn't have done that without it to that skill level if he hadn't practiced it already. And then just for people, just as a reminder to people, what happens, of course, it's a beautiful shot on a hill there overlooking the Pacific Ocean. It's as calming as you could ever possibly see it. He's in this group. He's doing the meditating. And then they've already hit the Zen bell one time, the group leader, and it's just a reminder. And so the bell goes off a second time when we have a close-up on Don's face. He gets a smile on his face, which speaks to like a total contentment. And they could have ended the series right then, but Matt Weiner cuts to the Coke commercial. And as I explained in my piece, I think that a lot of the confusion is that smash cut, that those were so close together. And it's a little unfortunate that they were. I think that would probably be my one critique of that part, because it did leave some people to wonder what that was. And it ends on this real life Coke ad we see, and then it ends. But obviously what, you know, as Matt Weiner talked about it in retrospect, and a lot of people who saw it talked about it and helped talk it out for viewers who didn't quite understand it. I think the clear thing is, yes, he did do the ad. He went back to New York And he made the ad, and as I argued in my piece, and I was happy 2 days later when Weiner talked about the actual Coca-Cola ad, I had said, look, why can't Don have had this not just an epiphany, because it took a long time for him to get there. He earned this change. So he has this change that he finds at excellence. He goes back and he makes this ad. Why can't he believe in the ad? And right. I think for me that was important, and I think you touched on it too. He believes in the sentiment of the ad. It's not – he's not saying, look, hey, let's sell some sodas to some hippies. He believes that this change that we're going to show you is what advertising can actually do. He's a student of advertising. He believes in it. He's like, why couldn't we sell this vision of change and of happiness and of coming together to the future generation, right?
Right, right. Something that – slipped by that I'm thinking about just now, because that was kind of in the water at the time. There's a shot where Joan's son is watching Sesame Street.
Right.
And yeah, it's a Bert and Ernie segment, but the whole idea behind Sesame Street was to take the commercial form and say, we can teach kids using jingles, right? Mm-hmm. These mm-hmm. minute-long segments, just make commercials for letters and numbers and concepts. And mm-hmm. and that was the whole driving force behind Sesame Street. And so I think that was a very subtle but very intentional shot in there to say, here's another example of commercial where it can be good, or the form can be good.
I think you're totally right on that. And as I've, you know, when I teach a class on at a visual studies class at an arts college. And one of the things that we talk about when we talk about great shows is that there are no accidental scenes.
Right.
There is no stretch of a great series where 3 or 4 minutes goes by, or even in that instance, you know, 15 seconds go by if it's not purposeful.
Right. You know, it's not,
they know what's in the scene. Right. Right.
It's not like, hey, let's just get a kid's show. It's
right.
We need Sesame Street.
Everything is thought through. There's a point and a meaning to every actual visual element that you see, because that the person in control of it is that studious about it. There is no wasted minutes in a show like that. And so I was happy also to see Weiner come out and say, look, and you know, it's unfortunate that I think the person who interviewed him was the wrong person to do it. I think that's pretty clear. Yeah. But maybe that was what he wanted. You know,
It was interesting, but it wasn't the interview we wanted to hear.
No. And to his credit, if you want to give him credit, he stayed, right? He was in New York, and he said, look, I will talk about this for like an hour or two, whatever, and then I'm done, and I'm probably never really going to talk about this much anymore. Contrast that with the fact that David Chase was in France when the lights went out on Tony Soprano. He was not around to talk about it. So there's a little progress. But what he did say there, which I found interesting, was that he loved the commercial. He believed that the commercial was – and he said, look, if you look at that commercial, the actual Coke commercial in real life, as cynical, you are you're basically being a cynical person, and you don't understand yeah. what they were trying to do and what it meant. And he thinks it's one of the greatest commercials of all time. And I think that sort of validated what I said about Don having changed so much that he could make that ad and believe in the message of it.
Well, and the whole – this whole stretch of episodes where he's been on the run, what mm-hmm. has he been doing? He hasn't been selling people on things. He's actually been helping them.
Yes.
Right? It's not just helping himself. It's helping that kid in mm-hmm. Wherever it was to say, look, if you go down this road, that's what's going to happen to you. And trust me, don't do that. Here, take my car.
Take my car. Right.
Right? You know, he's helping all these people along the way. He's helping the kids at the salt flats.
Right.
With their car.
He's going to fund their dream, you know. Yeah. I think that's pretty cool. He's out there to do what they want. Yeah, absolutely. And I made the point too that if you go back and you look at the entirety of season 7, which is 14 episodes, he's pretty nice the entire time. He's pretty happy. He's happy. He's nice. He's not a dick. And one thing I will say this too, and I got into an exploration of shedding all of his past. What season 7 did was he basically stripped himself of all this existential albatross that was around his neck. Yes. It took a long time to do it. He could admit to. I mean, the whole thing where he goes and he talks about accidentally killing his CEO, you know, and telling that to people who were fellow soldiers, to be in a situation where he does talk about that and then also, you know, talk about his identity to Peggy, where he gives his money away, where he's like he just wants to put things right in some way. You know, he writes Megan $1 million check. He's just like, you know, maybe I did mess your life up. I'm sorry. Here's how you can get it back. The shots of him giving up his apartment and giving up everything and being free from it and going on the road and giving this kid his car and, you know, on and on. He's really just – he was happiest when he was sitting in that with no car in the middle of nowhere in an Oklahoma bus stop, that smile that came across his face. Yeah. That was as happy as he was until he got to Esalen and we saw the very last smile, which was very similar to the one on the bench, a little more enlightenment perhaps.
Yeah. Well, I
loved very good season.
Their slogan at the time was have a Coke and a smile. So that, you know, having seen all the steps, as soon as the song started, I went, oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Again, nothing wasted, nothing unintentional.
No, and I think, you know, it's nice to know that, you know, we can, you know, so people are like, what if, I guessed at things too. I thought there would be, I didn't think he would use the phone. I got a lot of stuff wrong. You know, I didn't think he would use the phone. And I liked when he sort of addressed using it. He's like, yeah, no one, the idea to use a phone to communicate two emotion or three emotional conversations is kind of unheard of. So I was thinking, oh, well, we'll get like this, you know, flash forward where he ends up back in New York sometime before Peggy's dead. And he gets in a room with Peggy, or I'm sorry, before Betty's dead. And he'll get in a room with Peggy and they'll mop up their stuff and he'll talk to his daughter again, and but it ended up on the phone. Of course, person to person is the reason for that. But I really loved where it was. Also because David, I think the key to it was he did leave some ambiguity there, a lot of ambiguity. He gave you something concrete, right? He gave enough concrete part of the story where he's like, okay, this is where I want to leave you. I want you to know that. Peggy and Stan are happy together, and Trudy and Pete have reconciled and they're flying away. And Joan has made a very difficult decision about whether she needs a man in her life who understands her, and instead took her unfinished dream, which was to make something for herself, not buy into it, not do something with a car salesman she's going to regret, but to really use her own skills to do something and make a business. She chose that. That's a happy ending, and it hit its, you know, when she uses her own name for the actually two of her names, which is great in its own way. So he's like, this is what I want you to see as the series creator. And when he got to Don, it was showed us all of his change, showed us this personal contentment at this very well established, now kind of legendary Big Sur location that Esalen, and still all these years later, is still a worldwide magnet for people to come and seek enlightenment. And so in ways, it was perfect for that. And to show you just enough of Don to say, I've got him to the point where he's changed. He's made this thing. You can make some connections that I let you connect the dots. And then beyond that, with the construct that I've created, this is Weiner, you are now free as viewers to imagine whatever ending you want for them.
Yeah.
I'm happy with that.
I've given the world a home. I've furnished it with love. It's up to you to figure out what comes next.
Right. And if you want to be the person who says, you know, Don dies in 5 years of alcoholism, go for it. Because it could have happened.
Yeah.
You know, anything that you can imagine can happen. You could be the cynic who says, oh, you know, Stan and Peggy are never going to make it. Well, great. Okay. That's fine. But where he left us was where was good enough for me, and then you let your mind take it where you want to go, and then I'll, because I'm just very sure, David, that a lot of people are going to say, I take all of this into its happiest ever conclusion, and that's going to make them, that gave viewers something back for investing 7 years yes. Into the series. So it's beautiful. I loved it.
Yeah. And you know, as far as ambiguity goes, I much preferred it to The Sopranos, which I did not hate. I did not get upset when it cut to black. But that's a whole other podcast.
But you know what? I'll tell you what. Before I saw this ending, I loved – well, look, two ways. I loved the 6 Feet Under finale where you find out everything. Future and everything. I loved the Sopranos ending. I in fact, at the time that it happened, which is really important, specifically in the history of television and endings and finales, to do it that way, I thought was genius. I still do.
Oh, yes.
But it's not the most rewarding thing because it's it's left people bickering for years on end. So, you know, I don't think that I think the finale for Breaking Bad was strong, but not great. And I was happy with it. It was strong, but not great. I think they could have done a couple of darker aspects of that ending. But when now you see the next great series go out, which was Mad Men, and I think, oh, geez, I think he might have like really hit it on all cylinders on this one. I think that it is better than The Sopranos ending. It is, I think, not as pandering as the 6 Feet Under ending because it leaves mystery and intrigue, and you had to work to get to the revelations of how it did end here. Yeah. And so I thought, wow, I think we just witnessed, and in all honesty, I will tell you this was a better ending than I thought we were going to get. I thought it was going to be impossible to really get an ending like this. And I'm every day I'm happy to be surprised and shocked. And this is why I love that show. I think that this moved it to another level by making the finale so great. And I'm just a slight bit of future talk here, I guess, before we bring Jason back. And that is, I still have one more column to write. And that will be putting Mad Men in historical context among the all-time greats where it sits. And so I will just say that my happiness with how this all ended should be a hint about where that's going to go.
Well, to borrow a phrase you use often, I would say Hall of Fame first ballot.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, Jason has sent me some viewer mail. See, I've been watching too much Letterman this week. Listener mail.
Viewer mail.
So let's open up the CBS mailbag.
Okay.
But they're all Mad Men themed, so this is good. This is
great.
Good. So we've got Mike Ryan. Do you find any similarities or parallels between the woman in white who acts as the angel of death from Bob Fosse's All That Jazz, which is a movie I love?
Mm-hmm.
That's me jumping in. And Diana, who may or may not be an angel of death from this season of Mad Men. I've noticed that both the woman in white and Diana have hauntingly taunted Joe Gideon and Don Draper as their relationships evolved into a game of cat and mouse. Creative movements in the arts always ebb and flow with times. I think that's a separate question. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So do you see any parallels between the angels of death?
Wow. Well, you start with this one. I think you're invested in this one. Because I am actually interested to hear what you say.
Possibly. Mm-hmm. Possibly. One of the things that I loved in All That Jazz is that it's a seduction. It's not just, you know, oh, time to go. You know, it's not a Grim Reaper. It's Jessica Lange, young Jessica Lange, all in white and gauzy light and Vaseline on the lens. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But man, she's gorgeous in that film. And she's a marked contrast to everything else in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a really interesting way to portray death and the temptation of death. And you know, do I fight back from this heart attack, or do I just go into the light and have Ben Vereen sing Bye Bye Love? And that's a good way to go out. But yeah, until reading that paragraph, I don't think I had ever connected that to Diana in Mad Men.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, it is kind of dreamlike.
Yeah, the Diana thing was definitely dreamlike in the very first time we met her, which was the first one back, first episode back in the seventh season of the last seven episodes, I should say. I think that her character is really interesting, but I did think she served a purpose. I'm sure we could debate that on and on. She definitely, he was not in a fugue state when he met her. Was clear. I think my own amateur analysis of this, having watched every single Mad Men episode, usually 10 times over, about what it all means, is I think that it was a way to do two things. One, it was a way to kind of like confuse, like if you see a person who has a forward trajectory like Don, he has this death of Rachel Mankin and it really strikes him. He thinks that he knows this woman. And I think the thing is it focuses him on death and that about her importance of how Rachel is impacting his life in a way he can't quite put his finger on. Secondarily, I think in many ways, Diana is in some way Don. In a lot of ways, she's as dark and as lost as he was ever in his past, and running, clearly. She was clearly running from her family and her decisions. She was making bad decisions sexually, you would say. she was just ready to flee everything. And I think that Don, being in the new state, not the state that Diana's ever been in or is in right now, Don's new state, he wants to save her. The whole thing about him trying to save her because she was lost, I think that was him. And so even though I don't think that she was – I think she's a real character. She wasn't a figment of his imagination. I think that he was seeing in her a lot of stuff he was not able to realize that he was – it was transference, that he was a lost person and he needed saving. And that's what we got in that last – batch of seven, is he realizes he's lost and he realizes he needs to be saved, and he succumbs to it in that last episode. But yeah, I think that
there's that transference in a lot of things too, mm-hmm. with the kid in Oklahoma and with mm-hmm. Stephanie, you know, just keep running,
yeah.
Go forward, you know, and right. And he's sort of projecting onto all these other people. And
yeah,
and
he tells that kid that you can't. You know, he tells the kid that if you do this and you're going to have to change your name and assume a new identity, and it's not what you think, right? Yeah. That's him realizing don't make the same mistakes I have. I'm still trying to untangle myself from them.
So. And projecting his fears, like, you know, when he confesses to the vets about what happened in Korea. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not that their reaction is horrible or terrible, or, you know, it's he's afraid of what their reaction is going to be,
right?
And he, again, it's all projection and transference, and yeah, that's a really interesting thread. And
also that he gets beat up over something that's not what he thought he got beat up over with, but and he took the beating basically because he thinks he deserves the beating He still feels very guilty for you know, taking Don Draper's identity. So he takes that phone book beating pretty – it's almost like he deserved it. But yeah, I think part of the journey when he's on the road is he's meeting these people from Stephanie and everybody else to the point where it's all transference. He's all learning about himself, mistakes he's made, and he's trying to fix it in other people. And he finally realizes he's got to fix himself at the end.
Yeah. Well, here's another question, which I think is also from Mike. Creative movements in the arts always ebb and flow with the times. Naturalistic animation peaked under Walt Disney's guidance in the 30s and 40s, as was art rock with Brian Wilson during the Pet Sounds era of the Beach Boys.
Mm-hmm.
With all of that in mind, do you believe this movement of deliberately paced, ambiguous, and visual storytelling has reached the end of an era with Mad Men?
Ooh, I'm not ready to say it's reached an end of an era. I think if it's in the right hands with somebody, I mean, I am not ashamed to say I think Matt Weiner's brilliant, and what he delivered over seven seasons was something that no one has ever delivered over seven seasons, because no truly great show has ever gone seven seasons and done this level of creative achievement. Most great series are lucky to get through their fifth season and get out. And Wire included, and Breaking Bad included. So I think it will still go on. What I don't think we'll see anytime soon, and I talked about this, and I talk about this all the time. I'm kind of like a broken record about it, but I think it's one of the greats, one of those great things we have to talk about and say, you realize this is what's happening. It's a little bit of a bait and switch, and that is my personal, you know, look, I was a philosophy minor, and I was hoping to major in it at one point. So all of this stuff is fantastic to me. I love all that stuff, and I am totally consumed about like finding meaning in your life and having an examined life. And so this existential stories are, I'm drawn to them. This is exactly why I'm so interested in Mad Men. But I will say, I don't think we're going to see a story like this, because this was the ultimate. This was the ultimate like. Bait and switch when he went to AMC. It's like oh, it's going to be about the 60s. Well, it really, you know, the 60s, what happened in the quote unquote 60s were always a B storyline in this one. But everything that was great about it was the smoking and the drinking and the advertising and Don being so handsome and the sex and the messing around, and we developed these really funny, cool characters of their time. And you could spin a series like that. Modernism and also the changing evolution of the times and as far as like it being a period piece with changing costumes. But at the heart of it, this was a very, very unsexy story about one man's existential crisis, a search for identity and meaning. And honestly, that's a hard sell. That's a hard sell for everybody. And look no further than the finale. The parts of the finale that people didn't like were Leonard. You know, it's Leonard. Yeah. It's Esalen in itself. It's Leonard. It's all of that kind of earthy, crunchy learning about yourself part that's the non-sexy part of Mad Men. The sexy part of Mad Men is Don and his awesome shades knocking back an amazingly drink, you know, at noon. So I don't think that you're going to get somebody who's going to come and make a show like this that's character-driven and really slow and intellectually satisfying. That doesn't mean that it can't be done, but I think we're much more likely to see like another Breaking Bad where you have something that is also really smart and really well done and brilliant on so many different levels, but also is funny, fast-paced, violent, etc. That all the things that Mad Men were not.
Now we got one more long one that I'm just going to sort of cherry pick some things out of from Alan in the 415.
Okay, Erie Code of Record.
he did some post finale scoring. He did pretty well on predicting things, apparently. And for instance, he says the implication that Don returns home to create the ad at the end. Makes his road trip fit the classic Joseph Campbell hero's journey, which all right. You know, it's the hero returning home and gifting the community with the treasure he won during his journey, in which, in this case, it's his insight.
Right, exactly.
Okay, that's mm-hmm. fair.
That's good. Little Joseph Campbell at the ending, very apropos of Mad Men. Good work there.
Mm-hmm. I found it interesting that most emotional conversations took place over the phone. Mm-hmm. Yes, in most cases, this was a device to allow interaction between characters who weren't in the same place. But perhaps there was also the notion that these characters could only say these vulnerable things protected by distance, which, mm-hmm. again, that ties in with how distant he is even in the room with people mm-hmm. compared to where he gets to at the end. So I like that. Good job, Alan.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
During the last minute or so of the episode, several shots used moving cameras. For the rest of the series, it was almost all stationary shots with hard cuts. That's interesting. I'm going to have to go back and look at that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's funny that two shows on Sunday night used recreations of that iconic Coke commercial, Mad Men and Happy-ish. I'm going to say two shows did it. One show a lot of people watched.
And one show hadn't annoyed me so much that I wouldn't have got to the Coke version of that one.
That's right.
That's very funny. I did not know that because I was not watching Happy-ish because I was done with it. But interesting. Okay. All right.
So, no actual questions, just, you know, a couple of interesting points.
Yeah, it's
have,
funny how
I have
people,
one. Yeah. Hi, guys. Ooh, I'm back.
Hi, guys.
Hello, Jason.
It's Jason.
Hey, everybody.
I closed my eyes. I heard a bell and Jason appeared.
I did. Bob Mack wrote in, too. And this is also not a question, but I wanted to pass it along as you're wrapping up this segment, which is Bob Mack wrote, John Hamm is sure to win the Emmy this year, right? Right?
Yes. Sure.
Sure.
Wow. I mean...
Who
knows? I would give it to him.
I'd have given it to him years ago.
It's kind of amazing that no Mad Men actors have won.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable. The writing has won. So the show has won, but the actors, come on, let's reward these people.
Yeah. John, that poor John Hamm, he needs a break. He's horrifically ugly.
When are things going to turn around for poor John?
Yeah.
I love the fact that during the hiatus from these episodes of Mad Men that John Hamm went out and did like 30 Rock and all these Saturday Night Live. And he did all these great. He became
Kimmy Schmidt.
Yeah, he became a very, very funny comic actor. He always was, I guess, but he was able to finally show it. It's like some people would have taken what he did and said, okay, I'm going to go make these amazing movies now because I'm too big for TV. But he's like, no, I'm going to actually show you like the dorky side of me. I love that.
Well, the thing I love, I mean, I loved it on 30 Rock, but especially now with Kimmy Schmidt is, you know, here's this guy who is, you know, he's amazing as a dramatic actor, but he's fearless.
Yeah,
he's fearless. Watch those last couple of Kimmy Schmidt episodes. He is nuts.
Oh, so. Yeah. Oh, the whole SNL blackface thing was just like, he'll do anything, right?
Yeah.
That's a tough one to ask anybody to do, to say, can you pull this off in a way that we know is ridiculous, but you're still left open to interpretation for people who might not get it. He is fearless.
That live 30 Rock where he just, you know, it's that long silence and he just goes, banjo! I lose it every time.
Yep.
That is a trigger for him.
Well, I feel like that's a smart move on his part and his agent's part to get him a lot of comedy stuff to balance out the roster here because he's so well known for Mad Men to say, hey, doesn't all have to be existential despair. He's got this other thing going on over here.
Yeah, and he'll move effortlessly into movies if he needs to. And he's clearly as a guy who can do a lot of different things.
Yeah.
And my last thing I'll say about John Hamm, which I think is great to actually be able to say, and I've said it before, he is legitimately a nice person. Having seen him at a number of press tours that at that point he didn't have to attend and deal with press and, you know, random fans and strangers when he could have just said, had his agent or his publicist like shoo them away. He didn't, and he hung in there, his back to the wall, pressed by people, and he was honest and open and funny, and it was great. It's to the point where he hung around. I mean, I remember one party, he hung around at one point, and I was thinking to myself, okay, how weird is this? We've been out in this, we were in the Ritz-Carlton and at Pasadena, out on the deck, and I was standing with John Hamm and Matt Weiner, and it'd been a night of being basically slammed into the wall with everybody doing that. But at one point, there was no one around us. It was just the three of us. And John Hamm was being a total nut, just a goofball. And he was making fun of Weiner. He was messing with the music. He was like singing. And he's just, that's who he is, right? There was no airs. There was no front. And by the way, he hung out a whole lot longer than that and dealt with a lot of people and was nice the whole time. So it's like, okay, good. A real good guy. It's always nice to see that.
Yeah, a friend of mine went to high school with him and says because he's 44, so he's my age.
Mm-hmm.
She said he's a good guy, he's a solid guy. It's nice to know. Yeah.
Wow.
All right, David, thank you for being my Mad Men replacement.
Anytime.
I appreciate it. Would you like to stick around for the rest of the feedback?
At this point, why not?
Why not? This is like a marathon edition of the TV Talk Machine. I'll keep it. I'm going to punt some of these questions to next week. We'll get back to them. But okay. P. Page had a good one. P. Page, we know her.
Oh, yeah.
Long time fan.
OG. She's an OG.
She is an OG.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the best pieces of feedback we've ever gotten, so I wanted to make sure that we got it in. In an effort to bring down the IQ level of the podcast, I asked the following question. Don Draper, McNulty, Bunk, and Tyrion Lannister are drinking together. Who's the last one standing?
Oh, give me that lineup again.
Don Draper, mm-hmm. McNulty, Bunk, and Tyrion.
I have an answer.
I'm gonna go Tyrion.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I agree. Well, it's unanimous then. Tyrion Lannister will drink these guys. They're twice his size. Doesn't matter. He will drink anybody under the table, I think.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen it. Bunk and McNulty can't hold their.
Well, Bunk certainly can.
Bunk's
the first one out, followed by McNulty.
Yeah,
and then Don.
And then Don.
Yeah,
and then a couple of days later, Tyrion.
Yeah.
He's got a hollow leg.
So I hope we brought down the IQ level there, but at least we were all in agreement. Sarah from the 317 has a pretty easy one. You were telling Sarah on Twitter that she needed to send in some questions, and she did.
Yes.
What piece of on-set TV memorabilia would you most love to have? If you could just sort of pluck anything, I think, from television anywhere, what would be the thing that you would want to get?
And By the way, I made Sarah include her area code.
She's from the 317, yep. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Indianapolis.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay.
I think her vote is for the Jane hat from Firefly, which, fair enough, that's a good one. You can knit your own.
You can just knit your own, yeah.
But yeah.
Uh-huh. That's good. What
do you think?
And what piece of... stage memorabilia. I'm trying to think.
Like the Dukes of Hazzard car, do you want that? Knight Rider car doesn't actually talk.
I can't have the Dukes of Hazzard car because when we want to get into a discussion of really depressing things, we will revert back to that, and I will tell you about the Dukes of Hazzard car. It's a dark. We can only be a very dark.
All right.
Podcast.
Okay.
That'll be in our finale.
That'll be in our finale.
That'll be our finale. That's our dark finale. Mm-hmm. When we're at Esalen. We do a remote podcast.
We're hugging, and then you hear the Dukes of Hazzard.
I gotta say, I would like the furniture in Don's office. I would take any Mad Men furniture. By the way, I would like the furniture in Don's office, and I would also like that beautiful. Rolling bar cart from his office. I think Roger has one too, but I would take that for sure. All the chairs, the couch, all the off everything that's just in Don's office, I'll take it.
Wow,
David, do you have a favorite piece of memorabilia you would want?
Maybe Jim Rockford's answering machine tapes.
Oh, good one.
Or Johnny Fever's coffee mug.
Maybe that's good.
Or even like the call board from the 12th precinct. Maybe that would look really nice in my office.
I want I want Mr. Giles's big book of vampires that he shows to Buffy.
That's what I want. Look at that is nerdy and geeky and
big
a very
book of
smart,
vampires.
Yeah, that's a very smart.
It's
way.
A coffee table book.
It's also like something no one really had before, and it was like a one of a kind thing.
Yeah.
That had its own power.
Mm-hmm.
I say this as somebody who actually owns the Wilfred dog suit. So
yes, I know
that's
that
a thing. And part of the swag that has been given to us over the years, by the way, includes I actually have Michael Bluth's desk. Not his desk, but his little thing. This is Michael Bluth, president of the Bluth Company. I have that little placard. And of course, I think you probably guys have seen a number of people texted this out or tweeted this out ages ago. But when the office was closing out, they sent the same thing, the little desk thing, the little note, little placard for the desk. And it says Dunder Mifflin has the logo, and it says Tim Goodman, assistant to the regional manager.
Oh man!
So I have that. So those are things I didn't actually have
pretty
to
good.
Steal or take or anything like that. But yeah, I'm going to stick with mine, and that's a very good one, you guys. Very very thoughtful.
All right.
I know people with Detective Frank Pembleton's business cards.
Oh,
well, that's pretty
and,
good.
That's and good. One of my friends yesterday, while they were dismantling and throwing out the set from the Late Show, went dumpster diving, and he took several set pieces back to his office. So he's actually got, you know, some of the bridge work and some of the buildings and some of the exterior designs of the buildings from when they were designing it. They actually threw all that stuff out.
Oh, I love that idea right there.
Mm-hmm. So I said he was going to turn into Kramer doing the Merv Griffin show.
I don't really understand why they didn't take all that stuff and auction it off for charity. It's kind of baffling to me.
Right? They tore out all the theater seats, and I'm thinking, you know, schools could use those. Don't just throw them out.
Yeah, but, or you could sell them on eBay and then donate the money to schools. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of bizarre. Well, one last bit of feedback before we head out, and then we've got one other little last topic too. But it's from Hibsy in the 916.
Hibsy, okay.
He says, "How did Jason feel hearing one of his favorite songs in the Flash finale?" This is true. There's a wedding in the last episode of The Flash, and they play "Don't Dream It's Over" by Crowded House.
Mm-hmm.
And my answer is
there.
My answer is that just shows what a classic song that is from Neil Finn and the boys, that it is still getting used in TV shows. 30 years later. That album came out in 86, so 29 years later.
Can I add this, that I have not seen the Flash finale yet, but I will say that "Don't Dream It's Over" is one of my favorite songs ever as a pop song, because it is the Mad Men of pop songs. Mm-hmm. It is intellectually superior and yet quite enjoyable for all its pop shimmery.
And fitting for somebody who writes about television, given one of the lyrics in it. So.
Yes, exactly.
it's one of the rare pop hits that mentions the television page in the newspaper.
Turning right over to the TV page, mm-hmm.
Also, Hibsy says, Jason should review James Patterson's Zoo. It looks terrible.
You know what? Here's the great thing. It's if you would like to, because I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it for anything. I'm not sure. I know I mentioned this earlier. I don't know if you were around it. Maybe you were, Jason, when I said that my boss is still in Cannes. My editor is still in Cannes, and we were organizing all the stuff. And the last thing that I had to do, basically, was I had to review Aquarius, watch and review Aquarius literally last night. And then I'll be prepping for my soon-to-leave departure for going to the ATX Festival in Austin and then the Banff World Media Festival back-to-back. And I think I only have to review Orange is the New Black before I do that, which, of course, is a good one. But I told him, no more shows. I don't care what happens. No more shows.
So I'll tell you what. I will take up the challenge. I will watch James Patterson's Zoo. It doesn't start until June 30th or something. It's a ways off.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But it looks it does look terrible.
It's tempting, but I mean, you can't watch the commercials seriously. I laugh every time.
Every time. I try to imagine it's that other movie that We Bought a Zoo.
Oh.
But it's not.
It's not. It's James Patterson's Zoo.
The zoo is the most terrifying place in the world. James Patterson has a zoo, apparently. Who knew? What do you want to say about Aquarius before we go? That's sort of our last order of business, I think, Tim.
I will get into that. I will say that the one thing we joked about making you do things and watch things. And I had this, and now that we just talked about James Patterson's Zoo, which was not on my radar for having you do it. But I did chuckle to myself one night and I thought, oh God, right in front of us. Why? Like, it would have been great to have you watch every week and report back why anyone should be watching Turn, America's Spies. Uh-huh. That show that always follows Mad Men, and you're like, now Turn, America's. I was like, you could not pay me to watch that. I already watched it, and I thought it was terrible. But like, it got a second season. Why?
It's the Revolutionary War CSI Cyber.
Yeah, it's something else. But it'd be great if we torture you over a number of episodes. That's how my brain works, Jason. Not just one episode, but lots of them. Jason, what happened in the world of Revolutionary Spies this week?
You know, I'm just relieved that you didn't have me go back and keep watching CSI Cyber. And I fortunately haven't gotten sick lately.
It was renewed.
I know. Renewed. Oh, no, it's coming back. Ted it's Danson. Back.
Ted Danson.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, so Aquarius, David Duchovny. Okay, NBC.
Well, here's the short of it, because I think that's what we want, really. First of all, let's just say I don't understand how you make a series, it looks like a pretty expensive miniseries starring David Duchovny and a 13-episode limited series. Back to our special this year of all limited series. And then have I think it debuts on the 29th, so like a week from today when this goes up. And then they're going to just dump all 13 episodes online. And I just want to remind people that NBC is not Netflix and NBC is not Amazon. So dumping 13 episodes online so that you can watch them if you want, which basically is telling everybody, hey, no need to come back next week at this time period. No need to build our ratings. Here, we're just going to put it over here in this little pile in the ether. What is going on at NBC? I have no idea. Like, that just says don't watch the show. So if you're David Duchovny, you're probably pissed off. He's an executive producer of it. He didn't create it. But my short thing of it is it's set in 1967 Los Angeles. It's basically hippy-dippy heaven and they're trying to catch Charles Manson. And as I wrote the review, I said three things that you don't want to have happen. One, if you put David Duchovny in a show, which I'll watch pretty much everything he does. But when you watch him in this, you really – every time you see him, you're like, oh, dude, I wish you were in the X-Files remake right now. I wish this was the X-Files remake because you kind of look like Mulder right now. And you're looking good there. How about let's have something really weird happen and maybe have you track it down instead of tracking down Charlie Manson. Duh. And secondly, when you're going to have a Charlie Manson series, you better make him pretty scary – rather than like a hipster who just checked out of Starbucks. He just does not do it for me, this guy. And thirdly, and the biggest point is, well, we just finished watching Mad Men, and maybe this, Jason and David, maybe this ties in and this could be our thematic end to this podcast. We just got finished maybe the greatest drama series in history. And even that show, at its weakest point, tackled the 60s. And Matt Weiner was smart enough to say, okay, all these things that are quote-unquote the 60s, I'm going to make them the B storyline so that we don't become a really cheap documentary about what happened, 40, almost 50 years ago. And because the 60s, is my point, is it's such a caricature, it defies dramatic interpretation. And if the greatest series of all time can't do it right or do it justice or decide smartly to put it as a B storyline, what's NBC going to do when it comes to it? So you get a lot of like flowery, hippy-dippy talk. You get like – you just roll your eyes. It's everything is a cliche about what we know as a cliche in the 60s is. It's hippies. It's flowers. It's the way they talk. It's the man. It's marijuana. It's nobody has a cell phone, blah, blah, blah. And then you add Manson in. We already know about Manson. None of this, not one second of Aquarius was believable or compelling to me because, A, Manson wasn't scary. And it just seemed pointless, which is probably why it's being dumped into a pile in the ether that you can watch all 13 episodes of. But, yeah, please, people in the future – avoid doing anything about the 60s. Maybe the 70s. The 70s. Do the 80s. Do not do the 60s.
All right, that's a good way to end then as we leave Mad Men and we leave Aquarius. On the side of the road.
I will say I did tweet out and somebody actually apparently close to the production. I cannot confirm this. The person close to the production says they did clear the music. And it took a long time to do it, and I'm sure millions of dollars. But like, I was listening to it, and then my first reaction, you guys, was laughing because I was like, "Oh my god, they're not clearing any of this music." And it wasn't just like one big song. It wasn't just like the Rolling Stones. It was like, "Oh, here in rapid succession at this party are five of the biggest and most famous 60 songs of all time." I'm like, "I'm never going to clear this," but apparently, according to this guy, they did. So I don't know. The more money being burnt up in the ether.
That's right.
So good soundtrack.
Yeah. Good soundtrack.
Yeah, maybe you don't have to watch the show to hear it.
But you don't even need to buy the soundtrack.
You already
own these songs.
You already own these songs multiple times over.
Wow. All right, here's how you can reach us. You can tweet at us at TVTM. You can visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/TV Talk Machine. or you can send us an email at podcast@tvtalkmachine.com. That's the one you should use. And that's it. So, Tim, next week I'll be talking to you, and your bag will be packed. You'll be ready to go to Austin and Banff, but you won't be gone yet.
I won't be gone yet. I will probably have seen Orange is the New Black. I can talk about that.
Nice.
And then we can also talk about what's going to happen at these festivals, what I'll be doing there. And we can talk about whatever people send in.
We got some holdovers, and people can send in some new stuff, and we'll talk about
absolutely.
That too.
Hopefully we'll discover some new area codes.
Yeah, that could be. Somebody move somewhere. And send us an area code.
Okay,
that we haven't heard.
Jason. Okay, good.
All right, let's do that. Okay, and thanks to everybody out there. Tim, pleasure as always.
Thank you.
David, thanks for dropping in.
Anytime.
And we'll see you next week.